We're going fishing today on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry, and we have a panel of guests joining us. 3 weeks into angling season across Wisconsin, we want to find out how our lakes, streams, and fish are doing, along with your questions along the way. If you've got something to say about your favorite watering hole, questions about fish you are struggling to find, we'd like to have you join us at any time by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Our guests, all from our Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources today. Max Wolter is here, DNR fisheries biologist for Sawyer County based in Hayward. Focuses management of local fisheries, including the Chippewa flowage and Namekagon River. He serves on the DNR's walleye and bass teams as well. Max, welcome to you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Paul Cunningham is a fisheries ecologist for the DNR in Madison. He's concerned with the acquisition and stewardship of state properties and the management of habitat, particularly around shallow lakes. He's also co-lead of the DNR's Northern Pike team. Paul, welcome.
Happy to be here, Lee.
And Alex Latska is a Madison-based fishery systems biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. He coordinates research and monitoring of muskie, walleye, trout, and panfish. Alex, welcome to you.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm going to start with you, Alex, because May 3rd was the start of our angling season. The inland fishery season opened across Wisconsin. Wondering what you've heard so far from anglers and their success out there.
Yeah, sure. For me, fishing started off pretty good. Had a few good trout outings. But I'm not out on the landscape too much. I sit behind a desk in Madison most of the time. So I'll hand it to Max.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Max, you've been out there.
Yeah, I that's part of my job is to be out there to do fish surveys. So basically from the moment the ice goes off the lakes all the way through early summer, we're out there every day. Spring is an important time for Wisconsin fish. That's when most of the spawning is happening, which is, you know, the special fish word for the birds and the bees. So they're out there. That's kind of their one big chance to get it done. So that's when we're doing a lot of our surveys. Northern pike spawn first, then walleye, then we start to get into some crappies and muskies. So where we're at right now, many of these species are done spawning, which means they're ready to eat. And we're ready to eat them if you're out there fishing. There are some species like panfish that are still kind of going through their spawning activities right now, and that can actually be a really good time to target them because everything's up shallow. So this time of year is really a fun time to be out fishing.
It's the time to get out there and go fishing. What do you need to know before you go in terms of licensing and making sure that you're clear to fish?
Yeah, great question. So you got to have a fishing license unless you're under 16. Kids under 16 fish for free. We also have free fishing weekend coming up June 7th and 8th when anybody in Wisconsin can try out fishing without needing a license. So that's an exciting time to, you know, give it a chance.
What's the value of that license and what does it mean to the fisheries across Wisconsin? Paul?
Our fisheries program is mostly supported by our license dollars. So we don't receive a lot of general program revenue in the state fisheries program. So our revenue is sport fish restoration funds. So the taxes our users pay on tackle and boats and fuel, boat fuel, and then our license fee structure. And so that's the bulk of our budget, really, that comes to the fisheries program, other than our stamps, our salmon stamp and our inland trout stamp. So that is the power that enables our 200-and-some staff to do their jobs.
So the more licensing we have, the more our DNR fisheries can do.
Yes, yes.
And so that just makes sense. And out of state, in state, those levels are a little different. I also saw, like, if you're 98 or over, fishing is also unlicensed. Is that right? I don't think I saw. Yeah, if you're born
you're
after
stumping
before
us, Lee. I
or
don't know.
I didn't mean to do DNR trivia today.
It sounds like
it. On your
like
website
it.
Yesterday, it was like, people born before 1928 can fish without a license. And I was like, well, yeah, I would imagine we'd grandfather them in.
Yeah, it sounds reasonable.
Makes sense.
But they're still out there doing it. Great.
Absolutely.
We love that.
We invite them. So again, the license-free weekend is June 7th and 8th the state of Wisconsin. Otherwise, you should pick up a license because it goes to benefit our fisheries across the state and making sure there's fish for everybody when they find it. Getting your calls in at 1-800-642-1234, and let's start with some of your questions. We'll begin with Gary in Madison. Gary, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I had a question, and I don't know if you know the answer, but I'll ask anyways. I was wanting to know what the recommendations are for consuming fish out of Lake Mendota and Monona and Wabisa on a regular basis. Because I've heard that there's quite a bit of mercury in the water, and is there some type of standardized, okay, this is safe?
Gary, I appreciate the question. I see a lot of pan fishing happening on the shores of Lake Monona on my way to and from work, and I also see some signs there at the Monona Terrace that advise against eating some of those fish. Alex, what can you tell us about some of the heavy metals that are being found there and the safety of those fish?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Gary. The two categories of contaminants we have in a lot of lake streams and across Wisconsin and in the Great Lakes are heavy metals, your mercury and PCBs, and then the newer forever chemicals, all the PFAS compounds. So we do have a small contaminants program where we collect fish tissue and monitor it for all of those contaminants, measure the concentrations, and then relate those to what's actually safe to eat depending on your age and sex. So I don't know the contaminant advisories for the Madison Lakes offhand. There are a few resources you can look to. A lot of those signs that Dane County and the city put out will specify what the recommendations are. The DNR publishes a booklet called Choose Wisely that documents all of these contaminant safe eating recommendations basically across the state. And then later we'll talk about a tool that we put out online called the Wisconsin Fishing Finder. Yeah. Which is a map, basically, where you can filter, add all sorts of data, and view a bunch of different things for any given lake, and that includes a layer for contaminant advisories and what's safe to eat.
You mentioned PFAS, and those appear to be in just about everything right now, these forever chemicals. How is the DNR looking at these forever chemicals and what they are doing to our ecosystems and fish?
Yeah, so our role in fisheries is mostly looking at the fish tissue content, how much PFAS is making it into fish tissues, and we're looking all across the state. A whole bunch of different water bodies will collect tissues and send them into the state lab to measure the concentrations. So we're looking in areas where it's already been found in surface water or other potential endpoints. And then where we find it at concentrations that are concerning, we'll issue a safe consumption advisory.
And what those consumption advisories look like for folks that aren't familiar is, you know, you go to the booklet and it'll show the water bodies where there may be elevated levels of something. And it'll say, you know, it is safe to eat this amount of fish this often, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not saying, typically, it's not saying, you know, you can't eat any fish. It's just saying don't eat more than this or more often than this.
Yeah, and to Gary's specific question on the Harrachana Lakes, as I recall from our conversations with our fish toxicologist, it's the effluent from Truax Field, et cetera. Lake Mendota sits in the head of the watershed, and it's fairly clear of PFAS concentrations.
Okay.
But downstream on Monona, Wabisa, Kiganza, those have advisories for PFAS. And I think, Alex, I think it's a meal a month for bluegills and perch.
Okay.
It's a new advisory, so don't quote me. Check the Choose Wisely pamphlet, and we keep that up to date and current because, in general, we want people to eat fish.
Right.
Paul, but we also want them to eat safely.
Is that on the DNR website?
Yeah, Choose Wisely.
Choose Wisely.
Is, yes.
We'll get a link.
And
up.
It's all in our fishing finder that Alex will talk
oh,
about.
Oh, yeah.
Too.
We're going to get to that as well. But Gary, appreciate the call. We'll go to Ellen in La Crosse next. Ellen, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have a cabin on a small lake in central Wisconsin. And about 2 weeks ago when we were there, we found at least 6 or 8 largemouth bass dead on the shoreline. Talked to other neighbors. I think one other neighbor had found one. They were only largemouth bass, and they were really big, like maybe 12 to 16 inches long. I've never even caught a bass that big on that lake. But they were big fish, not all of them that big, but they were big fish and dead. And just wondering, and I haven't seen any since. We were there this past weekend, nothing.
Okay.
Is that, does that amount to a fish kill, or is that just a happen, something that happened random, or what could that be?
Ellen, I appreciate the question. Max Walter, you want to handle this?
Yeah, I'll start with this. So, you know, I mentioned earlier spawning is happening this time of year. It's also a time of year when fish are under a lot of stress. And so we do see fish dying from a variety of different diseases, parasites, things like that this time of year. The other thing that happened in the state over the last couple of weeks is a huge swing in temperatures, right? We were very hot.
Yeah.
Then the temperature crashed. The water temperature dropped about 20 degrees in my part of the state, and now it's coming back up. That's pretty hard on fish, too. They're a cold-blooded animal. So, you know, imagine how you feel when you have that fever and your body temperature changes just a couple degrees.
Yeah.
Now, imagine a fish, their body temperature's changing about 20 degrees. So when you have that on top of some of these other bacterial infections and things that can happen this time of year, we do see some fish kills. We're seeing some in my part of the state. Typically, it only accounts for a pretty small percentage of the population. Most of the fish are going to get through that event. The caller, Ellen, interesting to hear that it's largemouth bass. I might throw it to Paul in a second. We're seeing a lot of panfish that'll have those kind of minor fish kills in the north. So the largemouth bass thing may be something a little bit different.
So
not just largemouth bass, but the biggest that Ellen's seen, or bigger than anything she's ever caught.
Big bass.
Big largemouth.
Well, she only catches big bass. Ellen, we'd encourage you to send any photos you have to the local fish biologist. We often will follow up when we get these fish kill reports, and it could be the tip of the iceberg, and it could be a very isolated thing. Can't make a diagnosis on over the phone on radio, but largemouth bass virus could be one of the concerns. And a photo evidence, we would then, our biologists would consult with our fish health veterinarians. We have two in the program, and they would advise as well. And if needed, we would do a follow-up survey work if it was significant and assess that kill. So we have a fish kill investigations process as well. So for Ellen, if she gives us the name of the water body, we'll share it with our biologists after the show, or she's welcome to contact, was it Adams County?
She said Central Wisconsin.
Central Wisconsin, okay.
Somewhere.
Yeah, send it to the DNR, Ellen, and I a few photos, and while this might not help in a diagnosis, it may begin an investigation that the DNR will follow through on.
Yes.
Sounds good. That's Paul Cunningham, fisheries ecologist for our DNR. Also joining us, Alex Latska, Madison-based fishery systems biologist with our DNR, and Max Walter, DNR fisheries biologist for Sawyer County, answering your questions as we are going fishing today on the Larry Mueller Show. Have a line open for you now at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry, and you're listening to the Larry Mueller Show. Angling season underway across Wisconsin, and we're going fishing on the Larry Mueller Show with our roundtable of experts, Alex Latska from the DNR, Paul Cunningham from our DNR, and Max Walter from our DNR, answering your fishery questions at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. I'm curious, Alex, how much of a pastime is fishing in Wisconsin? I've seen some numbers that it's as many as one-third of Wisconsinites are fishers.
Yeah, it's a big deal. I'm not sure on the one-third. I'd say that sounds about right, but we sell about 1 million licenses a year for mostly in-state residents. Most of our licenses are sold to our in-state residents. It's part of the culture, right? It's the tradition. So
yeah, my story about fishing is that I've never caught anything, but it's always been me and my dad out on a boat, and the only thing catching we do is catching up, and it's the best. It's the best. Like, I really appreciate that time. I value it. I remember in Montello one time we took my dad's brother's boat out. The motor gave out. We ended up stuck on the wrong side of the lake, and it was one of the best days fishing I've ever had, and didn't catch a thing. That, to me, is like what it means to go fishing.
That's right. And I wouldn't say that is an uncommon perspective.
Yeah.
The most common angler, the most common thing that they're looking for when they go fishing is family time, the experience, the scenery, the aesthetics, all these things that go along with fishing. And A lot of people like to catch fish, but a lot of people are just happy to be out fishing.
Author and Wisconsin legend Jerry Apps was with Larry Mueller a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about the same thing, that fishing is something passed down in tradition, and having to see his children and his children's children all with a line in the water hanging out and slowing life down a little bit means a whole lot. But I'm going to go back to you on this, Alex. What does this mean for the pressure it puts on our state fisheries?
Yeah. Fisheries management, if you go through school, you get a fisheries management degree, you think, oh, I'm going to spend my career working on fish.
Yep.
I can understand everything about fish biology and spend my time in the water. And then you get to do the job. And there's some of that, but most of fisheries management is people management. Some of the biggest drivers of fish populations are how the people are interacting with them. How much fishing are they doing? How much harvest is occurring? And then how should we respond as managers? How do we kind of control, how do we regulate this system to produce outcomes that are ultimately desirable? How do people find the fishing that they want when there are these pressures? So it's all a balance. It's trying to make sure that people can harvest fish in a sustainable way. People can catch desirable size fish, trophy fish in some spots, or have these days where you want to take the kids out and just hammer bluegill or something. So try to have a mix of all these different experiences, try to balance all those different objectives.
Fish biology, it's easy to understand, not easy to understand, but it's understandable. Human behavior, well, that's another question
much
entirely.
And I'll build on what Alex just said. You can't have good fishing unless you have good fish habitat.
Nice.
And in fisheries, we may not always directly manage the habitat. It's not within all of our authority, but it's an important element that the department does in terms of regulating water law policy and what folks can do in the waters of the state, whether it's CAFOs, combined animal feeding operations, mm-hmm. to land use, to riparian residential ownership along a lakeshore or stream. Those things all matter, and cumulatively they can make for great fisheries or they can make for poor fisheries as well.
Well, you can apply that to humans, right? The habitat habitat around us, it can in many ways dictate our quality of life.
Right, and that holds for fish too. And enjoy the benefits of many of our Wisconsin residents are great stewards, and they understand this. So working with our publics is often a pleasurable task.
Let's go back to your questions now for our panel of experts on fishing across Wisconsin, all from the DNR. Mike and Madison, we'll turn to you next. Good morning.
Hi. I've been perch fishing the Madison Lakes for close to 50 years, and a buddy of mine and I have noticed the last couple of years that it's just about non-existent. We've been concentrating on Mendota simply because of the FAFSAs. And they're not there. They're not there in the summertime. They're not there hard water fishing through the ice. We'll go out if we catch two or three perch, that's a good day, and that just is unusual. Up until about 2 years ago, we go out and get 8, 10, 12 fish and go home happy with a meal. And it's not just us it's not just our poor fishing. I noticed that a local bait store here, DNS, has a fishing hotline, and they're scratching their heads about where the perch are and what's going on, too. I wonder if you guys can comment on that.
Mike, appreciate the question. Alex Latska, you're Madison-based fishery systems biologist, and you coordinate research and monitoring, among other fish, the panfish, which would include the perch in this question. What do you think?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Mike. So perch they've got a couple things that may be affecting what you're seeing right now. So perch, much like crappie, tend to go through ups and downs in their population cycles. And they can be fairly dramatic, where in 1 year, you can have, a lot of eggs hatch, a lot of young fish survive, and that year class will kind of perpetuate through time. So they grow up to be adults, and people are just catching that 1 year's worth of fish that came from whatever it was, 2018. So you do see these kind of natural cycles. That's one thing that may or may not be what's going on in Mendota. Perch are also a cool water fish. They're closely related to walleye, and a lot of our cool water fish have struggled as places have gotten warmer. Certainly walleye, perch to a lesser extent. So that there could be a habitat component of that as well. The third is always harvest, and panfish fisheries in particular are very harvest driven. Usually if people catch a 7-inch bluegill or an 8-inch perch, they're probably going to keep it and use it for their Friday fish fry. So with harvest in the Madison chain and the perch in Mendota in particular, we instituted a 10-bag panfish regulation a couple years ago now that was kind of responding to this perch situation in part. So it'll take a couple more years to kind of figure out if that has any benefit. But the idea was, okay, the population is lower than it used to be. If there is a harvest limitation from all the fishing that occurs, can we spread that out a little bit more? Can we keep those perch around a little bit longer?
What are some of the other fish that we're seeing that are struggling with warmer waters across Wisconsin?
I'd say in lakes, walleye are the key one that we can talk about. And I wouldn't want to ignore trout in our cold water trout streams.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier, fish are cold-blooded species, right? Mm-hmm. So they're highly susceptible to even small changes in water temperature. And what we are seeing across large parts of the state and other states, you know, when we're talking to our counterparts in Minnesota and Michigan and even Ontario, walleye populations are not as robust as they used to be. Walleye are a more sensitive species. They spawn in a very specific way. A lot of things have to go right to make more walleye. And what we're seeing is the effects of climate change, disruptions in the environment, disruptions in the habitat are throwing walleye off their game. So we're having less walleye in a lot of places that used to support them. River populations tend to be doing better than lake populations as a general trend. But that's certainly something that we're really focused on, because walleye are a prestige species, right? Everybody wants them. Everybody wants to have a chance to catch a walleye in Wisconsin. So we've put a lot of research into that to try to understand that. Trying to understand what sorts of things we can do as fish biologists to try to help walleye. That includes things like stocking and habitat work. But, you know, the difference between walleye and something like a largemouth bass, which we'd call as more of a generalist, is that sensitivity. Largemouth bass, they can spawn anywhere. you could dig a hole in your backyard, fill it with water, and a largemouth bass is going to think that's pretty cool habitat. So we are seeing, you know, largemouth bass and some other panfish species doing quite well, even as walleye are declining regionally.
So Alex talked a little bit about the perch population. That was Max Walter there, fisheries biologist for Sawyer County, talking about the walleye population. Paul, I want to ask you about our brook trout and their sensitivity to our water temperatures.
Sure. The other thing that the perch face that we forgot to talk about was invasive species. So there are a lot of food web effects going on that affect species like yellow perch. So we've lost our yellow perch fish fry in Lake Michigan, pretty much. And that's because of the benthification of the energy flows in the pathways. So with zebra mussels and quaggas, all that energy is tied up into the bottom. And when those larval perch are out there drifting, they're on a starvation diet. There's no zooplankton, no small critters for them to eat up in that upper surface. So these large-scale invasions of non-native species, aquatic species, can also affect the food webs for these fishes. And there are interspecific competition or problems even in the trout world. So we have non-native brown trout, which are a very popular fishery, that impact our native brook trout. So brook trout are our only native stream fish in the state. And then we've got the lake trout. And so they're in a unique position as our locally adapted trout species. And they're the what we call a stenotherm, a cold water fish. And they're one of our ambassadors to the health of our cold water streams. And with our ever-increasing high levels of atmospheric CO2, human-caused, is raising our water temperatures of our streams as well as air temperatures and altering the flows. We've seen these dramatic, you know, high flow events and huge storms and then drought.
Yep.
And so all this is affecting our brook trout populations. And our modeling estimates project that we'll lose 2/3 of our brook trout habitat by the mid-century, by roughly around 2050 to 2065. So that's a lot of habitat loss.
There is a brook trout reserves that is part of the DNR's fisheries program.
Yeah, once we saw the impacts of climate change on our brook trout, it was so sobering, we needed to do something. So Alex and our other staff, we sat down with a team of folks to try and identify the best of the best, these strongholds where we thought brook trout were worthy of securing their protection, their habitat, and we could hold the course, really, and keep these fish on our landscape, because they're an iconic, they are arguably the most beautiful fish,
well, yeah,
Lee, that you've ever seen.
There are some native tribes that will not eat that fish because it is considered sacred.
Yes, yes. And so these 54 places we call brook trout reserves are the best of the best. Some of them are still at threat. It's not like they aren't in need of management. Some of them need some rehabilitation work, some just protection and vigilance from already good land use practices. So we're working on these 54 places to try with our partners. There's a lot of folks that are interested in cold water conservation, and we're trying to partner up with them, U.S. Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, and others. And, of course, I can't go without mentioning Trout Unlimited, an important conservation partner for us and the land trusts to protect these places. So
that's Paul Cunningham, fisheries ecologist with our DNR, along with Alex Latska and Max Wolter, who are our guests for our fishing roundtable today, along with your input along the way at 800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. We'll go to Jonah in Greenville next. Jonah, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I was wondering what we can do as Wisconsinites, like just on a state level, if federal protections go away for our endangered or threatened fish.
Thank you, Jonah. I keep going back to our fish licenses and how that goes towards investing in our fisheries across Wisconsin. Max Wolter, you want to talk about what we can do to protect our fish at a state level?
Sure, yeah. And I guess I'll kind of talk generally about protecting all our fish, right?
Yeah.
I love the rare and the special stuff. We were fishing on the river the other day. My kid caught a moon eye. He was very excited.
Whoa.
There's so many species of fish in Wisconsin. Some of them are well known, like your bluegill and your walleye. Some of them are not well known. Some of them are truly rare. But all of those fish require habitat and protections for those habitats. And the more rare the species is, often it means they have very specific habitat requirements. And if those habitats are lost, if they're degraded, it's those rare and threatened species that are going to be the first ones to go. As far as, you know, federal versus state protections, all that stuff, it's difficult for me to speculate, what may or may not happen with those types of policies. But certainly Wisconsinites have a role to advocate for those types of things.
Yeah.
Throughout northern Wisconsin, private individuals have a huge role to play because most of the lakeshore is owned by private folks, right? So it's not federal land, it's not state land, it's somebody's cabin, and they're making the choices about what fish habitat's going to look like in front of their cabin or the stream running through their property. So individual landowners have a huge role to play, and then just everyday citizens advocating and saying, hey, you know, just because our legislators never heard of a shovel-nosed sturgeon, it doesn't mean they're not important.
Yeah, and a joy if you are able to get one on the line. Paul, you're the fisheries ecologist. A little bit more about how property owners in Wisconsin aid and abet our fish population in the state.
So let's talk about lakes first. As Max mentioned, they have a big, great stake. Often it's that portion of the water body that you step over when you get in your boat. It's that important edge, really. And so, you know, many of us are from a cultural European heritage where Germanic descent, where we need to clean everything up. That's, you know, we need our pastoral landscapes. And we brought these urban values to our lakes. Now, things are changing, attitudes are changing, but that effort of cleaning up your shoreline, making room for your two jet skis, your pontoon, and your fishing boat, and your two piers, there isn't much room left for messy, more natural habitat, tree falls, submersed aquatic plants, and emergent ones that grow, you know, like your rushes, your cattails, your white and yellow water lilies. So there isn't a lot of room left. And in our quest to find nirvana, we actually, in some degree, destroy nirvana to carve out our own space. Mm-hmm. And that's a challenge. And it's a challenge for all of us. And it's a hard thing. We like that habitat. Some of our waterfront property owners are doing very progressive things to restore that habitat, right, too. So I don't want to sound like a naysayer. Other property owners like that habitat, but they like to see it on the other side of the lake, okay? Not adjacent to their front. And so, but they all, one of the things that all our waterfront property owners do enjoy is seeing their grandchildren enjoy water quality, to swim,
yeah,
to jump off the pier, to be able to see more than 6 inches down in the water, to see the bottom in 4 or 5 feet, you know, to swim, to cast a bobber amongst the plants, to catch a bluegill, see a loon. Mm-hmm. Those are things, the common ground among all of us. And so protecting those things are about how we, as human behavior, what we choose to do and don't do on our waterfront properties. So the interesting thing on rivers and streams, that's not as big of a deal, because the unique nature of rivers and streams, they tend to flood. They push us back.
You can't clean them up.
It's harder.
Or if you it'll just come back, you know, again.
So lakes is the residential riparian development's a bigger issue on lakes. And we have a lot of resources for folks that want to protect and restore nearshore habitat. And we have grant programs, the Healthy Lakes Program, that provides funds for everyone to restore these sites. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, they're simple practices. They're not complicated. The grant application process is simple. We have folks that lead projects like putting tree falls back in lakes, restoring bulrush beds, installing grain gardens, et cetera. So there's a lot of positive movement on this front, too. And yeah, we hope to build that momentum.
You hear the stories about fish kills or low fish populations, and climate changes and invasive species and extreme weathers. It sounds severe, but it also sounds like everybody can do a little bit and make it a lot better. Like, there is a role for each and every one of us to play in our fisheries across Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I would add, it's not just the nearshore property owners, the riparian property owners. Even if you live up higher in the watershed in a forest, if you're a farmer, if you're a forester, lakes, streams, they collect everything that falls on the land and filters through the land. You know, they're these downstream receptacles of everything that's happening. So all the things that we do as conservationists, whether it's best management practices on our agricultural fields or reforesting areas, good land use practices tend to give us better water quality downstream, whether that's in a stream, you know, 100 yards away, or a lake 20 miles, 30, 50, 100 miles. So all those things that we're doing on the landscape can help our fish out further down.
That's Alex Latska, fishery systems biologist based in Madison, who also keeps an eye on our muskie, walleye, trout, and panfish. Taking your questions for our panel of experts from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources at 1-800-642-1234, where we go to Christy next in Chippewa County. Christy, good morning.
Hi, good morning. This is a fascinating topic. Thank you so much. And Max, I loved you mentioning the moon-eye fish, because as a birder, I was curious if there's a amazing species that you love to see. I'm watching for a Brachiosauridae this year. Two questions. So up here on Wasota, Chippewa County, occasionally this time of year, we'll see the DNR boat with the long arms. And I think I've seen them at night with bright lights, whatever. How are they doing the fish? Are they looking for certain species? Are the fish tagged? And then secondly, can someone just low-tech go out with like a bobber, and how do you know where to go and when to go? Just a general how to get into fishing question. Thank
you, Christy. Max Walter, go ahead.
Ooh, those are great questions, Christy. Yeah. I love hearing somebody from Chippewa County. That's where I'm from. Spent a lot of time fishing on Lake Wasota, so that question really hits right where I want it to be. We use a couple different methods to survey fish, and I'll just stick with lakes for now. Rivers can get a little more complicated. We'll use what's called a fike net, which is basically a super, super oversized minnow trap, and that's very effective for catching certain species like walleye, muskie, crappie. But the thing that seems to capture everybody's imagination is the electrofishing, which is what it sounds like you saw out on Lake Wasota. That's the bright lights. It kind of looks like a UFO moving slowly around out on the lake. And what we're doing there is we have special boats that have a generator on board that's generating anywhere from 200 to 500 volts of electricity, putting that into the water through these droppers. And what that does is it temporarily immobilizes the fish so that the folks up on the boat can look into the water with those bright lights illuminating everything, and they can scoop those fish up. Okay, so we can go along the shoreline. Wow. We can catch the fish that are there, even if they're not hungry. That's the big difference between electrofishing and angling, is we can go and we can get them under most circumstances. And then, we're going to be looking at how many fish are we getting per mile of shoreline to give us a relative abundance. We may be tagging some of those fish, which she mentioned. We use tags that are the same as what you'd call the chip in your pets, right? Oh. If your dog has the chip.
Yeah.
Yeah. We put the chip in muskies and sturgeon, and then that gives that fish an identifying number for the rest of its life, so we can track where it goes and how fast it grows and things like that. And then we can estimate how old fish are. There's so much information that we actually need as fish managers to be effectively managing these populations, delivering good fishing, making sure our angling regulations work, following up on our stocking to make sure we're getting the most bang for our buck there. So these surveys are fascinating for people, and I'm glad that you're seeing us out there. And then the information that comes from them is super, super useful. And because I've been out doing a bunch of electrofishing surveys recently, Christy, I can tell you that if you want to catch some fish right now in the next couple weeks, and probably including free fishing weekend, I would focus on 5 feet of water or shallower, maybe 2 to 5 feet of water, and don't overthink it. A bobber and a worm in 2 to 5 feet of water near any piece of what we'd call structure, which could be a log in the water, it could be the outside edge of some aquatic plants, even a dock is going to attract some fish. So 2 to 5 feet of water, and just hang that worm about a foot from the bottom, and you will probably catch something on Lake Wissota.
You're going to get a bite, Christy.
I believe in this.
That's Max Walter, fisheries biologist for Sawyer County, along with our other roundtable guests, experts, Alex Latska, fisheries systems biologist based in Madison, and Paul Cunningham, fisheries ecologist, all from our Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And there is also the Wisconsin Fishing Finder, which the DNR launched just last month. When we continue, we'll find out how we can all use this new tool. It is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and we've gone fishing on the Larry Mueller Show. It's the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and we've gone fishing with our panel of experts from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Alex Latska, fisheries systems biologist based in Madison, Paul Cunningham, fisheries ecologist, and Max Walter, who is a fisheries biologist for Sawyer County. Along with you and your questions at 1-800-642-1234. But before we go any further, I want to find out more about the DNR's new Wisconsin Fish Finder, how it works, and how we can use it to find the best fish across Wisconsin. Who's the best to answer that? Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, so you called it the Fish Finder. The Fish Finder is a thing you put on your boat that kind of sends sonar signals and tells you where the fish are. Unfortunately, we can't do that for you. So this tool... This tool is the Fishing Finder. The intent is we want to help people figure out where they can go fishing, what to fish for, what the regulations are. We talked earlier about the contaminant advisories, things they might want to know about any given lake, and where they can launch their boat, where they can access from shore, all these things.
Yeah.
So it's just a map. It's an interactive map with a thing on the left where you can toggle on and off all these different data sets. So you zoom into the lake of your choice, whatever you're looking to learn about. You can turn on the lake regulations to see by species what the actual regulations and seasons are. You can turn on, there's a category called opportunities, so things that maybe influence your choice and why you want to fish there. So it has our stocking histories, what we've stocked in that lake for the last 15 or so years. It has lake classifications, which are kind of these large groupings about different habitat types. Those we kind of categorize into what you might expect. Is it a trophy musky potential water, or is it an action bluegill water? So there's all sorts of groupings like that.
So it's a fishing finder. It's not going to find you the fish.
That's
It'll
right.
just find a place for you to and figure out where you'd like to drop your line. That makes a lot of sense. Let's go to Tom in the Rice Lake area for a question for you. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. My question is more of an opinion on sturgeon fishing. in Sawyer County and Rust County and over on the Flambeau River. Now, we've had a 60-inch limit for quite a few years. And what my opinion is, there's plenty of sturgeon, but not every sturgeon is going to get 60 inches. What I'd like to see is a slot size, say 42 to 48 inches. How does that go over?
Max, I will ask you how those limits are figured out and what that means for the population and whether or not we can do something about the sturgeon.
Sure. Yeah, and it's going to come back to two of our themes for this hour here, which is surveys and habitat, right? What information do we have on those populations? And then what does the habitat look like supporting them? We have some really healthy sturgeon populations in northwest Wisconsin. They're in rivers and connected lakes. We're talking probably specifically about the Chippewa and the Flambeau there with Tom. But a lot of species we are managing a little bit more on the conservative side, right? You know, we don't want to risk over harvest on populations. And so that's often how we wind up with the regulations we have. And then we'll continue to do surveys, continue to evaluate, look at how the regulations are working. Are they delivering what we want or not? And then sometimes we are able to, you know, loosen some things up, offer some more opportunities in certain circumstances. But, you know, that all flows from the surveys and what the fish are telling us.
Yeah. And so just to reiterate, why are you being overly cautious sometimes when it comes to these limits and sizes?
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's sturgeon in particular, such a fascinating species. They live for a very long time. It takes them a very long time to get to even the age where they're going to spawn. And they also have really specific habitat requirements. A lot of their habitat has been fragmented by dams. That's been a major disruption for sturgeon over the last few hundred years. So, you know, we tend to manage a species like that on a more conservative scale. So it's interesting, an interesting call. And, you know, it's certainly something that, you know, could be in the picture in the future. I guess I can't commit to anything right here and there, though.
Yeah, but you're always looking at it.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, we were just out doing a survey on the Chippewa River this year. We got a 71.5-inch sturgeon.
Whoa.
Very cool to see a fish that big. Yeah. 6 foot long.
We have a follow-up to the question earlier about the perch population in Lake Mendota in Madison. We'll go to Bob next. Bob, good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I just was curious on what you think about the size limit on northerns on Lake Mendota, for example. I believe it's, what, 40 or 42 inches. That's a darn big northern. No one's going to eat it, but I do believe, in my opinion, that would eat up a lot of perch in a day. What's your comments on that as far as the size limit on the northern pike on Lake Mendota?
Paul Cunningham, you see a connection there?
I see a connection to a trophy fishery for northern pike. Uh-huh. So in fisheries, we're about trying to create a portfolio of opportunities for a diversity of anglers across the state. And so there is no average angler. There are a group of anglers as well that enjoy catching and releasing and seeing pike over 40 inches, just like our muskellunge.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are a lot of anglers that would like to harvest pike too. So we've set aside Lake Mendota as our trophy fishery of the Hera chain.
Okay.
And we have other fisheries in southern Wisconsin where there's no minimum length limit for northern pike and a 5-daily, or no minimum 2-daily, or a 26-inch minimum length limit and 2-daily. It's just that right now, Lake Mendota is our premier northern pike trophy fishery. The average size of those pike in Mendota excel and rival everything. The only comparable is probably Green Bay.
Do you think they are part of the reason for the lower perch population?
No.
Okay.
No. Energetically, they're fairly low density. They will eat perch.
Okay.
More so in the food web, walleye are the bigger predator of yellow perch in Lake Mendota. So, but a lot of the perch population levels, are influenced by a lot of different issues beyond those two species. So in the prioritization of who's eating who out there,
right?
It would be walleye eating yellow perch. Northern pike might be eating the walleye. Because those pike have a big gape, and they can consume about 40% of their prey length. So if you figure a 40-inch northern pike can eat a 16-inch walleye.
Whoa.
And Alex Latska, I would imagine that that fishing finder from our DNR might be able to help Bob out in finding a place to catch the northern that he'd like to eat.
Yeah. There is there's a couple tools you could use in there. If you turn on, if you look in the regulations layer, you can see which lakes are have that 26-inch minimum or a 40-inch minimum. There's only a couple. So.
Yeah, I appreciate the call, Bob, and the question as well, the comment as well. I want to go back to my fishing experience and how it's a bonding experience, Jerry Apps fishing experience and how it's a generational experience and just how it goes beyond the actual tackle box, the line and the lure, how it goes to the tradition in Wisconsin. And Max Walter, I'll start with you and your nine-year-old's life list and how that plays into fishing in Wisconsin.
Sure, yeah. So some people may be more familiar with the life list in the context of birding, right? You're going out, you want to see all these, you know, rare ones. You want to, you know, see a bird you've never seen before. My son and I are doing the same thing, and he's in kind of a privileged position, having a fish biologist as a father. I know where some cool fish are, but you still have to go catch them, right?
Right.
We still have to put in that time together to say, you know, our big catch last year was a hog sucker. So we went to this river that I knew had some hog suckers, and it took us all day to catch one of these, you know, stinking little hog suckers. It was about 11 inches long. It is the highlight of his summer, you know, catching this rare fish and be able to say he did it, and we did it together. And that's, you know, one of many different pathways that fishing can take you on.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody's going to go out and fish for something rare and silly.
You're the guy that got the moon eyes. So.
We got a moon eye. We got a hog sucker. Yeah, we got to give some shout outs to these fish. We can't talk about walleye all day. But, you know, that's just our pathway to fishing. There's so many other pathways that people have, that families have, traditions that get passed down, the places you're going to go, the way you're going to fish, the stories you're going to tell.
Yes.
That's what it's all about, right? Is the one time that something crazy happened that you're going to tell for the next three generations, and the picture's going to be on the wall at the cabin or the resort or whatever.
Or it might not be a picture at all, but those fishing stories are legendary and passed down generation to generation. Paul Cunningham, you are now a grandfather. You've got a three-year-old granddaughter. Tell us about your fishing experience.
Yeah, well, I think in fisheries, we are about creating the opportunities that make memories.
The experience.
Yes, and you know, we can manage the fish as best we can, but really the aspect of, now that I'm a grandpa, taking my three-year-old Winry out in Eau Claire,
mm-hmm.
Going shopping for first fishing tackle to Farm and Fleet Farm in Eau Claire, shopping for all her gear, you know, buying night crawlers. The idea of putting a night crawler in a hook and teaching her, exposing her to the outdoors. And our goal was, it was her third birthday, was three blue eels on her third birthday. So to the caller on Lake Wissota, the goal was for Winry to be able to cast near the aquatic plants, not necessarily in the dense bed, but on the edge, cast out there. And three bluegills was it. It was for a three-year-old.
Yep.
That was enough. And it was a memorable, when she sees me, she thinks about fishing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a memory for her. And
well, and for you too, obviously,
yeah.
Paul.
Yeah, I know. And I'm talking about it now on the Larry Mueller Show. So
not
there
just
you
talking
go.
About it.
That's
you're
how
beaming.
Important these fishing experiences are to our public. We're just a cross section of anglers in the state, and we're no different.
I love those stories, and I thank you so much for your perspective and your work on behalf of the experiences that we all get out in Wisconsin's lakes and waterways. It's been a pleasurable hour, and I thank you all for joining me today. I also want to apologize to everybody who didn't get their questions in, but we'll just have to have our guest back. That was Paul Cunningham, you heard last, fisheries ecologist for the DNR in Madison, focused on the acquisition and stewardship of state properties, the management of habitat. Also heard from Max Walter, DNR fisheries biologist for Sawyer County based in Hayward. His focus is management of local fisheries, including the Chippewa Flowage and Namatkagan River. And Alex Latska, Madison-based fisheries systems biologist with the Wisconsin DNR, all with our Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and I thank them for their knowledge, wisdom, and experiences out in Wisconsin's waterways. Safe fishing, everybody. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry Mueller today. When we continue, we'll take a look at a new technology that's being used by our native tribes to find fresh fish on our Great Lakes. That's after the news here on The Larry Mueller Show. It's the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. And our next guest has been working with our Native American tribes around the Great Lakes. You know, it's as though our Native tribes have always been fishing on our Great Lakes. It is part of the tradition, their tradition, and it is something that has sustained their communities. But more recently than not, those fresh fish have been found to contain contaminants like heavy metals, PCBs, and PFAS. So how can Native tribes around the Great Lakes find food that is safe and keep their traditions alive? That is why we speak to our next guest, Matt Dillinger, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the Medical College of Wisconsin and co-investigator at the Great Lakes Native American Research Center for Health. He's telling us about an app that determines whether the fish that are caught in the Great Lakes are safe to eat. And you can join our conversation at any time by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@WPR.org. Hey, Matt, welcome to the Larry Mueller Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your work with our Native American tribes around the Great Lakes, how long it's gone back, and what your work is focused on.
Well, my background is in human health risk assessment and ecological risk assessment. And as a graduate student, going back over a decade now, I started working with the tribes on some fish consumption advice projects. And I got involved in some federally funded programs as a graduate student to help them. And I was at the time learning how to do basic human health risk assessment. And as a graduate student, I got a lot of experience doing that. And that's how I got introduced to them. And the reason they're interested in the fish consumption issue is, as you mentioned, it's a very important, culturally important food for them. And it's also commercially important.
So in your work, where did this start? What did you first find when it came to the fish that our Native tribes were catching around the Great Lakes?
Yep. So the concern was that using human health risk assessment techniques, the EPA and some other government agencies had identified a potential excessive risk from chemical contaminants like mercury and polychlorinated biphenyls, particularly in the Great Lakes area. And that risk could be elevated for tribes who eat fish more frequently potentially than the general population. And so they started, many of the tribes in the region have their own fisheries assessment programs. And the one I was partnering with is out of Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan in the UP. And they started monitoring the fish species that they eat the most. And so in the case of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe and the tribes in the UP of Michigan, they eat a lot of whitefish and lake trout. And so we have 30 years of data on these chemical contaminants in whitefish and lake trout. But with all that data, you need to figure out what to do with it and how to get that information to the public, be they tribal or anyone, to help build some advice for them. And so we were building brochures and simple infographics, trying to explain the complexities of the risks and benefits of eating fish, because fish are generally a beneficial, nutritious food to eat. And we were trying to condense a lot of data and science that goes behind the calculations into some simplified messaging. That's how it started. It started as kind of pamphlets.
So it started as pamphlets, but it has now evolved into technology, and there is an app that now incorporates this data, as I understand it, Matt. And tell us a little bit about this app and how it works, and whether, and you've studied this now, you wrote a 2023 paper about contaminant concentrations in Great Lakes fish. How is this app responding to it?
So about 10 years ago, I wrote a grant for to the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences to take the fish consumption advice that we were working on and build it into an app, a mobile app. And really the idea there was to take all those calculations and those algorithms that estimate the extent to which someone might be approaching or exceeding a government recommended level of intake for mercury PCBs, I was able to automate that into mobile software, which is also on the web, and bring a more nuanced set of advice for multiple species for people. And we wanted to see how they would react to that. So that was the original study. And that was rolled into two different studies over the past 8 years or so. And we did use the data that you're referring to in the 2023 publication. We used about 30 years of data to make sure that we were on track with what the overall trends and contaminants were, because those can change over time. So after we pilot tested the app using some basic data, we then updated it using more comprehensive data from our tribal partners who are sampling the fish that their tribal fishermen have brought in from the lakes themselves. And we also supplemented that with state of Michigan data, and we created a more comprehensive app. And that allows people to interact with it, put their weight in, select meal sizes, and then it gives them a long list of potential fish that they might eat, and it tells them how many they can eat per week or per month or something like that based on their weight and their personal risk profile. And so we found that was very well received, and we've been testing it, like I said, over the past decade to see how people respond to it as we update it. And so far it's been a hit.
Yeah. And so when you analyze the results of this app that incorporates the research and data of contaminants from these fish, what do you see as the outcome and result? And would this be an opportunity for us to employ this app as well?
Yeah, I think that I mentioned pamphlets and infographics at the top, because before it was common to use software like this, that's what we had to work with to try to simplify the messaging. But Because we can instantly do these calculations in the back end of your phone or a web browser, we can give a little bit more nuanced advice, more tailored advice, and it's more powerful and more useful and overcomes some of the limitations of the amount of assumptions you might make for just giving some rule of thumb recommendations on eating how much walleye a pregnant woman could eat, for example. The app eliminates some of those assumptions. And of course, now that we're in 2025, pretty much everyone has a phone in their pocket. Yeah. And I think there's a potential for everyone to be engaging with environmental data this way. What we found was that for the most part, we ran a clinical trial, a randomized controlled trial, not clinical trial, controlled trial on a few hundred Anishinaabe Native American participants, adults. And we asked them for a month pre and a month post using the software, how much fish they ate. And then we were able to use the same calculations that we built the app off of to assess whether or not they were exceeding government recommendations, which is, by the way, a little slightly different than predicting someone's risk of a health outcome. This is whether or not they were approaching or exceeding the government recommendations on intake for certain chemicals, mostly mercury and polychlorinated biphenyls. And what we found was that really only the maximum intake scenarios across the board where people were eating the most fish that they reported to us were exceeding the levels. Up to the 75th percentile of both controls and people who used the software stayed within the government recommendations. And we did find that people who had the app used it, liked it, and reported that they would consume more fish and select healthier fish as a response of having it. And they did all of this while eating a relatively elevated amount of fish and staying within the government guidelines. So as I mentioned earlier, EPA and others were worried these tribes might be exceeding the government guidelines, maybe elevating their risk from certain contaminants. And while it's a legitimate concern, what we're finding with our data is that for the most part, people were eating a fair amount of fish, maybe not as much as they would like to, but they're staying within those recommendations. So that should alleviate some of the fears, particularly when they're using our software. And then we did a follow-up, a 2- and 3-year follow-up on the software. And we asked people if they were using it, if they would use it regularly, if they would eat more fish, if they could use it, if they feel more confident about serving fish to their family. And our numbers went from during the trial from things like 50 to 69%, all the way up to 95, 97%. So significantly improved responses to the software when we gave them, as we were updating the software and as we had a campaign promoting it over the past few years. So all very positive results demonstrating the potential of using this technology.
It is having a beneficial impact. Matt Dellinger, our guest, Associate Professor of Epidemiology in the Institute for Health and Humanity at the Medical College of Wisconsin, co-investigator at the Great Lakes Native American Research Center for Health, coordinating biomedical research initiatives in the Bemidji, Minnesota area, taking a look at how our Native American traditions are being helped and the safety of our Native communities are being supported by new technology, specifically this app, which is combining 30-plus years of data now about contaminants in Great Lakes fish and how that can be employed to minimize health risks. So, Matt, could anybody use this app? And if so, where do they find it?
It is on the Google Play Store and the Apple Store, and it's also on a website that anyone could get access to. And I'd be happy to provide that link to your producers.
Yep.
Anyone can use it, but you should be aware that the data that we are using, even the data that we requested from the state, is limited to the 1836 treaty areas. Okay. 1836 treaty areas, it's a specific boundary in northern Michigan that covers a certain amount of tribes that have, in 1836, they signed a series of treaties with the federal government dictating that they could, if they went by ceding their territory and going to the reservations to join the reservation system, one of the conditions with it was that they could continue to hunt, fish, and gather within that broader area. So that's, you know, that covers Huron, Superior, and Lake Michigan areas. And so that's a specific geographic region. It's a fairly large one, but it tends to be less, the fish in those areas tend to be a little less contaminated than the ones in, for example, southern Lake Michigan, which is something that we mentioned in our 2023 publication. So those caveats are important. And this is what the app is built around. And one of the motivations for doing that was to make sure that we were giving them the data that was most relevant to them and not unduly frightening people with data that could be not as relevant. So for anyone who's living outside of that northern Michigan area, the software is still helpful to give you a sense of which fish are going to be relatively less contaminated than others, because that tends to hold up across species. So if you were to go in and download it and enter your data, enter your body weight, your intended meal size, and whether or not you're a woman who's going to get pregnant, because the most sensitive human to these contaminants is the developing fetus, you'll get a good sense of how many meals per week or month you might eat for certain fish. And in general, you'll find things like walleye are a little higher in mercury. Lake trout can be a little higher in PCBs, although that's decreasing per our 2023 publication. And it'll give you a general idea of where those contaminants fall out. And that would hold true outside the territory, but you really need to be aware that we've built this on data that is on relatively less contaminated fish than you might find in our more southern areas of the Great Lakes.
Does mercury and PCBs, as you mentioned, and other contaminants accumulate in some fish more than others? Are there types of fish where you see more of these things?
Yeah, the species matters, and that's because these contaminants bioaccumulate in the food chain. Mm. So if it's a smaller fish, like a perch or a bluegill, they don't accumulate as much mercury and PCB because they're lower on the food chain. And so the mercury is a good example. It's a ubiquitous contaminant. Mercury is a part of the environment, but it can be mobilized into biotic media via methylation of the mercury, so you get methyl mercury, it's organic mercury, and then it starts to accumulate in like phytoplankton and then and other plankton, and then those get eaten by the next thing up the food chain, be they fish or maybe crustaceans or something like that. And then as each time an organism goes around vacuuming up, eating up all these other organisms that are maybe slightly contaminated, they accumulate that contamination because it doesn't leave their body at a very high rate. So it enters their body at a faster rate, and they accumulate at a faster rate, then they eliminate it. And so then you get up to the higher trophic levels, the higher up the food chain, you get to a fish like a walleye that eats a lot of other fish that maybe have been eating other fish that have been eating other fish. And those fish were eating invertebrates, if you get the idea. So the walleye, which is a very delicious fish, is kind of high, it's very high in the food chain within the aquatic ecosystem. And so they, and because they're very muscular fish and not as fatty, they tend to accumulate mercury in their muscles. So walleye and pike are one of the classic examples of something that tends to be a little higher in mercury. Lake trout tend to be a little higher in organochlorines like polychlorinated biphenyls, because those are lipophilic contaminants, and similar to the mercury, they accumulate, but they tend to store in the fat, like a fatty fish, like a salmon or a trout.
Matt Dellinger, we talked last hour to the DNR fisheries, and PFAS came up, the forever chemicals that we're just finding pretty much everywhere and in everybody. Is that something that you intend to study down the road, or is that have you looked at that as an epidemiologist yet?
Yeah, I've looked at it. That's a good example of what I was alluding to earlier. There was a study that came out in 2003, around the same time the My Contaminant Trend paper came out. And they used data from all around the Great Lakes, and they found alarmingly high levels of perfluorinated compounds in fish, which could potentially be triggering. They could exceed some of the aforementioned government levels, but those government benchmarks are also kind of a matter of discussion right now. So there's a lot of caveats to this. I do mention it in my 2023 paper. We did do some pilot studying. Some pilot testing of our lake trout and our whitefish from the tribal fisheries for PFAS. And we found those numbers, I believe, because I'm going from memory here. Mm-hmm. I believe they were about half of what the other paper had found. So again, it depends on where, it can depend on where. The EPA is doing some really important work on the testing methods of PFAS, especially in fish, to make sure that we're not maybe biasing some of those results. That's a little outside my expertise, but I've read some interesting briefs on it. So people should really stay tuned to that. PFAS are not the sole... In humans, mercury is almost comes exclusively, and PCBs as well, those almost come exclusively from eating fish. That's not the case with PFAS and some of the other forever type of chemicals, the very persistent organic pollutants. You can get PFAS from all kinds of sources.
Right.
And I'm working on some research right now, yes, to try to get a sense of where these things are coming from and how much of that contribution is from fish and how worried we should be. My personal thoughts on that is that we should be careful not to scare people before we're sure.
The science is still out and the research is still ongoing. Matt Dellinger, where does your research go from here? What are you looking to explore next and get answers to?
So the technology, of course, has accelerated in recent years.
Yeah.
We're beyond now just simple apps using little algorithms that I basically, the original algorithms that we built, I gave my my programmer at Shorewood Tech some basic equations that I built, and it's a relatively simple math to do that the software can handle easily. Now we're dealing with artificial intelligence and language learning model type. Algorithms yeah. that are becoming commonplace in both app programming and using them in the software themselves. So that's a really a growing area that my group and I are trying to wrap our heads around as quickly as we can.
Yeah.
We want to expand the use of mobile and other technology in not just the tribes, other rural groups, everybody in the Great Lakes region, everybody in the world, perhaps. We want to see this environmental data at people's fingertips in a usable and understandable way. And we do not intend to limit ourselves just to fish.
Yeah.
I'm primarily interested in the food chain, but there's other exposure science to be done. And so that's kind of where we're looking right now. We're, you know, it's difficult to apply for grants right now, but that's more or less, that's what we're doing.
Well, I find that fascinating, epidemiology at the age of artificial intelligence and how some of these large data sets and large language models may change the way epidemiology is done from the very, at its very core, and how that could be applied to the research that you've done so far with our Great Lakes fish and our Native American tribes who fish on those lakes, and what that could mean for food safety going forward, whether it be our fish, our game, or even perhaps our grocery store.
Yeah, we need another half hour or so. Maybe.
Exactly. But and to go back to where we started here and just get some of the what our native tribes have said about incorporating new technology into their ancient traditions and how those two work together as you see it in your work, Matt.
You know, those traditions, the beautiful thing about those traditions is that they're almost like a living thing. They are dynamic and they evolve and yet they're stable and they convey wisdom that we humans have used traditional knowledge and culture as a vehicle for information over the generations, dating back long before we had software or even writing, anything to put down and record. And I think it's really exciting to try to use the rapidly developing technological space as a place to play around with promoting very, very well-established, well-respected and important old ideas and concepts. And so I view culture in my work as the same way I view the ecosystem as an ecologist with an ecological background. And I do have a degree in ecology. And those are dynamic systems that evolve over time. And they're responsive to feedback. And so tribal language and tribal culture is tremendously important to the people that we're working with. And it's that provides important context for us to be able to convey nuance when we're trying to convey a difficult scientific concept to people. It's crucial that we integrate with the culture that has been developed over time and adapted to the Great Lakes region in this case to help people make decisions about their health, not just in an age of technology.
Matt, thank you so much for sharing your work with us today, and we will have to keep up with you and find out what's next and speak with you again. Thank you.
No problem. My pleasure.
Matt Dellinger, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at the Medical College of Wisconsin, co-investigator at the Great Lakes Native American Research Center for Health. And details about that app that we talked about are available on the Larry Mueller Web Show page at WPR.org/Larry. Don't forget that Larry is live from Bayfield in Bloom on Friday. You can listen from 11 to 1. And last checked, if you are in Bayfield, there are still some tickets left. You can find those at online at WPR.org/Larry. Oh, and if not there, be sure to listen in to Garden Talk live from Bayfield and Bloom with Larry Mueller on Friday from 11 to 1 right here on WPR News. Good afternoon. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today. Larry's back on Friday live from Bayfield and Bloom. Hope you can join us for that. But here's the news. The Wisconsin Knows Nelson Stewardship Fund is up for debate right now in Wisconsin's budget deliberations. The federal volunteer conservation program known as AmeriCorps is also being questioned as to whether or not it will continue. And that has raised other questions about how local organizations are responding and how conservation efforts will look in the future. So for our show today, we have joining us the executive director of the Mississippi Valley Conservancy, Carol Abrahamson, and the Driftless area, they work as a land trust in the Driftless area, also executive director of Gathering Waters, which is an alliance of more than 40 land trusts in Wisconsin. Mike Carlson, Carol and Mike, welcome to you both. And Carol, I'm going to start with you today and get right into it with the work that the Mississippi Valley Conservancy does in the Driftless area and your focus in that region.
Well, thank you, first of all, for having us on. Mississippi Valley Conservancy covers 9 counties along the Mississippi River in the Driftless area. And primarily we work to, and those landowners continue to own the land. They can sell it, pass it down to family members, do all the things that they currently do on it. The conservation easement is just restricting future development rights on that land. And then the other thing that we do is we occasionally acquire property, and that property is then open to the public for things like hunting and fishing, bird watching, just enjoying time in nature. And of course, it is habitat protection as well.
Thank you. And Mike Carlson, the Gathering Waters, tell us a little bit about this group.
Sure. It's great to be with you, Lee. Thanks so much for having us on. Gathering Waters, we're Wisconsin's Alliance for Land Trust. So we work statewide. We were actually just over the last year celebrating our 30th anniversary. So we were founded in the mid-1990s. And the Wisconsin Land Trust community has grown quite a bit over that time. So when we were founded, there were about a dozen land trust organizations working here in the state, and that number has grown to just over 40 today. So it's really been a remarkable growth. It's, you know, really in every corner of the state. We have land trusts or land conservancies working with local communities, with private landowners to help protect really special places across across Wisconsin.
So what does a land trust mean exactly, Mike?
Yeah. So when we use that term land trust or land conservancy, we often use those interchangeably. What we're really referring to is a nonprofit organization that has a primary mission of protecting land. And, you know, we like to say that in Wisconsin, each of our 41 land trusts is pretty much as unique as the landscapes within which they work. So some focus on conserving high quality prairies or forests or wetlands, while others may be protecting things like family farms, or in some cases even, you know, supporting the development of urban parks and trails. So it really depends, you know, what communities those land trusts are working in. But when we use that term land trust or land conservancy, we're really talking about those nonprofit organizations around the state.
And Carol, you mentioned, you know, protecting our natural habitats against the encroachment of development. And why is this important to these 41 land trusts that have now extended across the state of Wisconsin as you see it?
Well, it's really important to the folks of Wisconsin. We know that people in Wisconsin love to fish and they love to hunt. They just love to be outdoors. Bird watching is a big pastime of people in Wisconsin, and they want to have land that is available for them, for their families, and for future generations. So that's why the work that land trusts do to protect this land from development is so important. Private landowners, they want to be reassured that when they sell their land, it's going to remain as it is. Oftentimes they've spent a lifetime working on prairies and forests and even farmland, and they want to make sure that it will remain that way. So this is a way that they can be assured by working with the land trust in Wisconsin to protect their land from this future development.
And Mike Carlson, why the growth of these land trust conservancies since Gathering Waters began 30 years ago now? What is it about these land trusts and conservancies that have spoken to the people of Wisconsin and seen so much investment?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's important to maybe mention, you know, up front that, you know, land trusts are just sort of one piece of the puzzle when we think about land conservation here in the state. Obviously, there's really important public agencies like the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources that protects things like state parks, state wildlife areas, state forests. There's, you know, county governments that have county park systems and municipal governments as well. So I think over that past 30 years, though, I think there was a recognition that the, you know, government agencies couldn't do it all, and that there was really a need to have these community-based nonprofit organizations that could be, you know, just responsive to what local community members thought were priorities, thought were important to protect. So I think that's really a large reason why we've seen that growth is just there's been so much interest among members of the public in supporting these local community organizations. I think I'll also sort of tie in here a topic that you mentioned at the top of the segment, which is that there's no question that the growth of the land trust community is also relates to the history of a state program called the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program mm-hmm. that provides public state funding to land trusts and other partners to assist them in protecting land and providing that for public outdoor recreation. The Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program was founded in 1989 in a very bipartisan effort at the time with, you know, Governor Tommy Thompson was in office, and he worked in a very bipartisan manner with the legislature to create the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program. And actually through that program, for the first time ever, the state had a grant program then that provided these matching grants to nonprofits, to land trusts. So that state support has been essential in that kind of growth and expansion of the land trust community over those three decades.
So it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the reason for creating this Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Fund, the reason for the support of our conservancies and land trusts, our state parks, our natural habitats, and, you know, preventing to some at some level in some places development from occurring, has to do with our quality of life, has to do with what makes Wisconsin special, has to do with why people live here, why people come here, and why people spend their tourism dollars here, that what we have here is special because of the people who are committed to keeping it that way. Does that sound about right?
No question. Yeah. And I think we like to sort of refer to it as the three W's, water, wildlife, and the Wisconsin way of life are just so, so broadly popular and, you know, it's just such a high priority for such a wide swath of Wisconsinites. We actually recently, we partnered with one of our land trust members, the Nature Conservancy in Wisconsin,
yeah.
and commissioned a public opinion poll. This is something that we typically work with the Nature Conservancy to do every couple of years. And again, this most recent round of polling showed that more than 90% of Wisconsin voters support continued public funding for land, water, and wildlife conservation. And that cuts across party lines, that cuts across geographies. It's just one of those issues that really, I think, where there's just a lot of common ground among members of the public.
Yeah, because we recognize the value of what it means to live in Wisconsin. Carol, can you talk a little bit about what the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Funds means for the Mississippi Valley Conservancy?
Yes, absolutely. What it means is opportunity. Over the years, and Mississippi Valley Conservancy was founded in 1997, so we'll be coming up on 30 years pretty soon. But over the years, the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Fund has provided over $6.5 million just to Mississippi Valley Conservancy, and it has helped to protect more than 5,400 acres right here in the Driftless area. We could not possibly have done all of that work without the help of the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Fund. It provides 50% of the funds that are needed for an acquisition. So we still have to go and raise matching funds, reach out to our communities and our supporters and our partners to fill in that gap. But it sure does kickstart every project that we undertake. Those projects are preserving habitat, water quality, the scenic views that we have here along the Great River Road.
Yeah.
And then they're also providing the public access for hunting, fishing, birding, hiking, all of the things that the people of Wisconsin really love and value.
So this investment from the state, it doesn't happen without other buy-in investment from the community through the Mississippi Valley Conservancy.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. As I said, it only provides 50%. And I don't say only lightly. That's huge.
Yes.
But it really then inspires our supporters and our partners to step up and help us finish the projects.
To me, there's just nothing else like the Driftless in the entire Midwest, Carol. And you know, you mentioned it a little bit, but tell me a little bit more about what makes the Driftless so unique.
Well, it is a really special area, and I'm super proud to live and work in the Driftless area. It is an area that when the last glacier came through, it just missed this area. It went around this area. So we have very unique valleys and bluffs and rock formations. Of course, the Mississippi River, a lot of beautiful streams, class one trout streams that are in the Driftless area, wonderful cold spring fed streams that are great for fishing. So it's very unique. If people haven't been to the Driftless area, I highly encourage that you put that on your bucket list. Come and visit us. And then while you're here, stop and hike at one of the properties that Mississippi Valley Conservancy has protected for you.
Mike, I want to talk a little bit more about what the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund would mean, the loss of the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund would mean for the 40-plus organizations that are now part of Gathering Waters. What would it look like without it?
Sure. Yeah, it's a pretty stark to imagine, to imagine Wisconsin not having a state program to support land conservation. I actually, Lee, just briefly want to maybe take a quick step back and just a little bit of history. I think the name of the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program is pretty meaningful, and I think really speaks to the broad support that it has among the public today. It's actually named after two former governors, Governor Warren Knowles, who was a Republican, and Governor Gaylord Nelson, who was a Democrat. And actually, going all the way back to the early 1960s, when Governor Gaylord Nelson was governor in 1961, he helped to spearhead the creation of the first ever state program for land conservation. It was called the Outdoor Recreation Act Program, ORAP, funded back then with a penny a pack cigarette tax, if you can imagine that, generating enough revenue. So Governor Nelson helped to spearhead the creation of that program. But then it was up for reauthorization in 1967, and Governor Knowles really picked up the mantle. Governor Knowles was a big angler and a big outdoors person, and really picked up the mantle and helped to expand the program. So the history of land conservation and outdoor recreation in Wisconsin goes back truly for decades and generations. At a certain point in the late 90s, it was decided that there needed to be a sort of a refresh, a new program created. And that's when, the governor at the time, Governor Thompson, and the legislature decided to really honor, I think, that bipartisan history by naming this new program the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program. Again, so over, since the stewardship program was founded, there's been just tremendous impact. In total, the stewardship program has helped to protect more than 750,000 acres of land in Wisconsin, and that includes DNR purchases and county forests and other partners. But that's just a tremendous impact over that time. Specifically, for land trusts and local partner organizations like local governments, the stewardship program over that time has provided over 4,200 grants, and that includes more than 700 grants to land trust organizations. So, again, as Carol described, it has been really the source of support that's jump-started conservation efforts literally in every corner of the state. I would always recommend folks can go on, and actually we have a website dedicated to Knowles Nelson. It was knowlesnelson.org. Knowles starts with a K, so knowlesnelson.org. Yep. And we've actually mapped by county and by legislative district every single Knowles Nelson investment. And it's remarkable. So I really encourage folks to go look at, you know, either their home county or if there's a certain corner of Wisconsin that they, you know, have a particular love for, just really go look. And every time we've shared one of these maps with, you know, with elected officials, more often than not, the first word out of their mouth is, wow. They just, you know, folks really don't appreciate how much of an impact that it's had.
Well, they might appreciate it. They just don't know it because we're living in it. And although, Mike, you mentioned how bipartisan it was at the beginning, bipartisan seems few and far between these days in politics, no matter where you look. But can we find some common ground when it comes to the common ground that we live in, share, and appreciate that makes Wisconsin what it is? Our guest, Mike Carlson, executive director of Gathering Waters, an alliance of more than 40 land trusts in Wisconsin, and Carol Abrahamson, executive director of the Mississippi Valley Conservancy, a nonprofit accredited land trust in the Driftless area of southeast Wisconsin. We invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you are listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Talking about the three W's with our guest today, that would be water, wildlife, and Wisconsin's way of life. Our guest, Carol Abrahamson, executive director of the Mississippi Valley Conservancy, and Mike Carlson, executive director of Gathering Waters, an alliance of more than 40 land trusts in Wisconsin. And Carol, are there others? We talked about the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund, which is up for debate, and whether or not that funding will continue and how much it is done to keep Wisconsin what it is today. Are there other sources that we find in state funding that could be up for grabs or could be lost going forward as you see it?
Well, I'd like to talk about some federal funding that we lost recently.
Okay.
So we had hired an AmeriCorps position for the summer, which we've done for the last handful of years. It's a really great way to bring a young person into the conservation community, help them to get some experience, to build their skills, and see if conservation is really what they want to do for a career. So we had made an offer to Emily. She had accepted it. She was coming all the way from Vermont. And 2 days later, as you probably already know, the AmeriCorps program was defunded by the federal government. So that left us in a bit of a predicament. We needed Emily's help for the summer, and she needed a job that she had planned on for the summer. We felt terrible.
Yeah.
And we decided to just go ahead and ask our supporters if they could help us out. So we were able to surpass our fundraising goal with all of the caring people here in the communities of the Driftless area pitching in to support Emily's position here with us this summer. AmeriCorps is really vital to not just conservation and environmental groups, but communities across the nation. It's an extremely important program. So we're really quite excited that we were able to basically restore the funding with our supporters here, but it's not a great situation and one that I hope will be restored again.
Carol, I have to admit, in the flurry of all the news of what's happening in Washington, D.C., I did not realize that AmeriCorps had been defunded. I knew there was talk of elimination, but it's hard sometimes to figure out where it is in this process. But we're seeing real results of what's happening in the budgeting on Capitol Hill right now, not in the White House right now, right here in the Driftless region.
Yes, we are. There are other organizations in the community that depend on AmeriCorps employees. So it isn't just us, but we're thankful that we're able to bring Emily. She'll be starting with us next week.
Well, geez, Mike, let me ask you, have you seen any direct results of the loss of AmeriCorps funding at the federal level with the Alliance of Land Trusts that make up Gathering Waters?
Yeah, for sure. I was actually just out in Washington, D.C. A few weeks ago, meeting with Wisconsin congressional offices, trying to kind of sharing some stories from back here in Wisconsin. And I was joined by the executive director of a land trust in the Milwaukee area called Restoring Lands. Their executive director's name is Tom Stolp. And Tom had a very similar story to Carol's in terms of that loss of AmeriCorps funding and sort of how that threatens, you know, their program there locally in Southeast Wisconsin. I would say at a sort of higher level, though, you know, I think the three main areas that we're seeing kind of challenges at the federal level, really, I think there's just, and you described this, Lee, I think there's just so much uncertainty right now.
Yes.
That really is creating challenges for local partners, and kind of three main areas I think that folks are paying attention to. One is, you know, funding for actual, like, federal funding for projects, which, you know, federal funding often is used as a match for the state Knowles-Nelson stewardship program. So the uncertainty of the federal funding is a big concern. There's also a concern about the capacity of federal partners, and, you know, oftentimes federal agency staff will provide not only financial assistance, but provide technical assistance to conservation projects, whether that's, you know, wetland restoration or forest management, prairie restoration. So that the sort of federal partner capacity is a big concern. And then access to data too is another issue. I think, you know, land trusts have become far more sophisticated in how, you know, we use data to really inform conservation that's happening on the ground. And there's obviously lots of federal, you know, data that is, again, I think there's a lot of uncertainty about the future of the access to that. So, you know, federal funding for projects, capacity of federal partners, and access to data are kind of three main buckets, I think, that we're hearing concerns about.
Just short on time, but Carol, I'd like you to see if you can answer this as quickly as possible, because I got an email from Mel that said, some people think too much money is spent or that the tax base is lost when land is set aside and protected from development. Is tax base really lost through this process? And do you know how much money land protection can save in future costs, Carol?
You know, of course, there is some tax base loss, but really, when you think about the future, protecting this land, you are also protecting from things like floods, which the storms that we have lately, the last few years, and I'm sure we will continue to have, they're devastating. So when you look at water protection alone and how flooding can be devastating when we have heavy rains, but then also just protecting our drinking water, there's a lot of cost to that as well. So yes, there is some tax-based loss. Now, we do pay taxes on some of our properties. Of course, landowners continue to pay taxes. That does not change. They continue to pay their property taxes. But the land that land trusts acquire, some of them, we do continue that. We also make payments in lieu of taxes to communities to help support their local emergency services that we need to access as well.
Oh, I didn't know that. And Mike, in the 60 seconds we have left here, can you give us a quick cost benefit analysis of the work that Gathering Waters does?
Sure. You know, we've tried to do some research on kind of the benefits of public lands and land protection. And one number that we came up with was that the state has invested around $1.5 billion in the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program in the past three decades. And we've determined that that roughly translates to actually $2.5 billion in value that comes back to the state every single year. And that's things like Carol mentioned in terms of, you know, flood management, but it's also the impact on the outdoor recreation economy and quality of life. So there is, I think, a pretty tremendous return on investment. And we've got actually more information about that on that KnowlesNelson.org website.
KnowlesNelson.org. Mike and Carol, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, Carol Abrahamson is the executive director of the Mississippi Valley Conservancy, a nonprofit accredited land trust in the Driftless area of Southeast Wisconsin. Mike Carlson, executive director of Gathering Waters, an alliance of more than 40 land trusts across our state. Thanks for being a part of the Larry Mueller Show today, and thanks to our team, Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaw, Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. A reminder, Larry Mueller is live from Bayfield and Bloom on Friday. Friday. He brings you garden talk from the northern parts of Wisconsin. Hope you can join us. If you can be there, wpr.org/events. Otherwise, listen online at wpr.org or on the radio. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.